Well, we're in the book of Daniel, and Daniel chapter 5. We have come to a situation where a bizarre king named Belshazzar, he's actually the king's son, left in charge, and everything has fallen apart. Medo-Persia has invaded. They're surrounding the city. They just can't break in. So he throws a banquet and gets drunk. And then, as he's sitting there in this magnificent hall, fingers of a man's hand appear and start writing in the plaster behind him where the candle light was shining, spotlighting it. And he turns around and he's completely horrified, drunken state in the first place, and alcohol is what do they call it? It makes you sad, you know. What is it? Yeah, it's a depressant. And so we always talk about the happy drunk, but usually it's a sad drunk is what you find. The last memory I have of a sad drunk was doing this, and everything was dripping, you know. Well, he cries out for all the wise men. He's come so far from Nebuchadnezzar that Daniel is evidently off on his own someplace. Perhaps had made enough money. He didn't have to work. He was an older fellow by this time. So he doesn't call him, just the secular wise men. But we see here his frustration in verses 8 and 9. Then came in all the king's wise men, but they could not read the writing, nor make known to the king the interpretation thereof. So they had no idea. Then was the king Belshazzar greatly troubled, and his countenance, the Aramaic literally the brightnesses, was changed in him, and his lords were astonished. As the later speech of the queen mother indicates, Daniel was not among these wise men. Daniel was no longer a major player in the political field, nor was he chief of the wise men. He would have been at least 81 years old at this time, perhaps retired. Or at least just tired, I don't know. We find that the king summons Daniel. How does this happen? Well, the queen's advice, the queen's comfort. Now, the queen, by reason of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banquet hall. She was not there carousing, but she came in. And the queen spake and said, O king, live forever. That's the way you talk to a king. O king, live forever. Let not thy thoughts trouble thee, nor let thy countenance be changed. The evidence is that this was not his mother, this was not his wife, but was in fact the queen mother. Verse 2 said that his wives and concubines were already in attendance. So this was somebody else. She sounds more like a mother than a wife. Guesses have been made as to her identity. Some think she may have been a widow, one of the widows of Nebuchadnezzar, who was taken by Nabonidus, the one who usurped the throne, to strengthen his right to rule. Others think she was a daughter of Nebuchadnezzar, and that seems to be, in my opinion, more likely, but we don't know. Then the queen offers her comfort, and then she expresses why he doesn't need to be so frustrated. The queen's memory, there is a man in thy kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. She was close enough to Nebuchadnezzar, whatever her relationship, to remember what Daniel had done. And in the days of thy father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, was found in him. And this father would refer back to Nebuchadnezzar, whom the king Nebuchadnezzar, thy father, the king, I say thy father, or grandfather, made master of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. the queen's encouragement, for so much as an excellent spirit and knowledge and understanding, interpreting or of an interpreter of dreams, and showing of hard sentences, and dissolving or of a dissolver of doubts, of knots, the dissolving of the knot, that's the solving of a puzzle, were found in the same Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation. I kind of like this because Daniel ended up being known as Daniel. And a little side note, little footnote, by the way, Nebuchadnezzar called him Belteshazzar. You know. So evidently he's known now more as Daniel than Belteshazzar. The king's offer, his revelation of Daniel's person. Then Daniel was brought in before the king, and the king spake and said unto Daniel, art thou that Daniel which art of the children of the captivity of Judah, whom the king, my father, brought out of Jewry? Jewry meaning the place of the Jews. We don't get any answer from Daniel, but I have this picture in my mind of an 81-year-old Hebrew man walking in, stepping over prostrate bodies that had passed out on the floor, winding his way up and standing there waiting patiently for this character of a king that throws a party in the face of destruction. And so I imagine him now, art thou this Daniel, you know? And he goes, you know, that's it. His remembrance of Daniel's characteristic. I have even heard of thee, that the spirit of the gods is in thee, that light and understanding and excellent wisdom is found in thee. Perhaps he had heard stories as a child. His mother reminded him of this, and perhaps she was the one that told him about it earlier. But I remember you. I heard the stories of you. His remembrance of Daniel's characteristics. I've even heard of thee that the spirit of the gods is in thee, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom is found in thee. Then his reason for Daniel's presence. And now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me, that they should read this writing and make known unto me the interpretation thereof, but they could not show the interpretation of the thing. So he makes a report now of Daniel's ability. I have heard of thee that thou canst make interpretation and dissolve doubts. And he offers this great reward. Now, if thou canst read the writing and make known to me the interpretation thereof, thou shalt be clothed with scarlet, have a chain of gold about thy neck, and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. He was only the second ruler, son of Nabonidus, so he could only offer the third. And we see the wise men's interpretation. First of all, the refusal of the reward. Daniel answered and said before the king, let thy gifts be to thyself. You may keep your gifts. You have to recognize that to be honored by a king who's on his way out is not exactly the greatest of things. He says, let thy gifts be to thyself and give thy rewards or fee to another. Yet I will read the writing unto the king and make known to him the interpretation. He says, I don't need to be paid for this. I'll do it for free. But he takes the time as an old man to reminisce of better times. The example of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was favored. O thou king, the most high God gave Nebuchadnezzar thy father a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. Reminding everybody of the lessons learned that God showed that Nebuchadnezzar was given that authority. Nebuchadnezzar was powerful. And for the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he slew. Whom he would, he kept alive. And whom he would, he set up. And whom he would, he put down. This is by contrast to now you're huddled in a banquet room with the enemies at the wall outside. Everything's falling apart for you, you see. It didn't for Nebuchadnezzar. And then Nebuchadnezzar was proud. But even this man, when his heart was lifted up and his mind hardened in pride, or to deal proudly, Nebuchadnezzar was taught a lesson. He was deposed. The Aramaic, literally, the King James margin tells us, made to come down from his kingly throne. And they took his glory from him. And he was driven from the sons of men, and his heart was made like, or he made his heart equal to the beasts. And his dwelling was with the wild asses. They fed him with grass like oxen. His body was wet with the dew of heaven till he knew that the Most High God ruled in the kingdom of men and that he appointed over it whomsoever he will. The same kind of pride that God dealt with Nebuchadnezzar is now evident in Belteshazzar. And so he applies this lesson from the example of Nebuchadnezzar. He applies the lesson to Belshazzar, his failure to learn Jehovah's lesson. And thou, his son, O Belshazzar, hast not humbled thine heart, though thou knewest all this. You decided you could get away with your pride, and then his disrespect of Jehovah's vessels, but hast lifted up thyself against the Lord of heaven, and they have brought the vessels of his house before thee, and thou and thy lords, thy wives, thy concubines have drunk wine in them. What was wrong with that? Well, these things were made and dedicated to the true and living God. And that was they were sacred. They were holy vessels, meaning they were separate from common use. Here they are in the most common use. And then his misuse of Jehovah's vessels. Thou hast praised the gods of silver, of gold, of brass, iron, wood, and stone, which see not, nor hear, nor know. Now, Daniel had not been part of this banquet, but he knew exactly what was going on. Perhaps even as he was summoned and was asking the Lord for help, this was revealed to him. I don't know. Perhaps there was assistance with PDA stuff, you know, and saying, hey, now here's what's going on in here, and bringing him up to speed on this. His blasphemy of Jehovah's person and the God in whose hand thy breath is and whose are all thy ways thou hast not glorified. That's a scary phrase. The God who holds your life in his hand, you've not glorified him. Well, we see then the writing and its meaning. The writing then was part of the hand sent from him, and this writing was seen. And this is the writing that was written, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. Daniel reads the message in Aramaic. I'm assuming that it was written in Aramaic. This causes a little problem because the people in general spoke Aramaic. So the wise men shouldn't have had any trouble reading it, but it specifies that they not only did not know what it meant, they didn't know how to read it. So perhaps it was written in an obscure way. If the vowels are removed, as they are in Hebrew, if the words were written vertically, the message would have looked like this. Now, you have to realize you have four words starting from the right, moving to the left. And so it could look like that, probably without the frame, but that's a possibility. So if so, then it would have been something of a puzzle, and they wouldn't have known how to read it, much less what it meant. So this kind of puzzle, probably what stumped the wise men. Another possibility is that the letters were in a form that only Daniel, by God's revelation, could decipher. And we don't have any idea of what that would look like. He now explains the meaning. Numbered. This is the interpretation of the thing. Mene, God hath numbered thy kingdom and finished it. This is numbered. It's counted out. You know, you've dealt the last card on this thing. Weighed, and mene, mene is twice. Tekel, thou art weighed in the balances, and you're found wanting, lacking. You're the light the light thing. You don't have the weight. And then divided, Perez, thy kingdom is divided, given to the Medes and Persians. He had read earlier Upharsin, now he says Perez. The difference is that Upharsin is a combined word. The U is the word and Pharsin is the plural of Perez. Brother Jebediah told us at a former time that the difference, one of the differences between Aramaic and Hebrew is that the plural for Hebrew is I am, and the plural for Aramaic is I N. Here's the example of this plural. So the conclusion of the story, the delivery of a worthless reward. Then commanded Belshazzar, and they clothed Daniel with scarlet, put a chain of gold about his neck, and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. Daniel understood the urgency of the message, and that being named the third ruler of a fallen kingdom is of no benefit. The death of a rebellious king in that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain. So the warning came, but this was the warning, not change your ways and things will be better. The warning was, you've been numbered, weighed, and now the kingdom is to be divided. The Euphrates River ran north and south through, I guess it only ran one way, but I'm saying running in the sense of plotting it out on a map, north and south through the city of Babylon. According to one ancient historian, Cyrus, the leader of the enemy forces, diverted the river as it entered the city, and when the water level lowered, his men entered the city through the riverbed. Since walls were all along the river, the plan would have been disastrous for Cyrus if the Babylonians had been on watch. But they weren't. The historian relates that Cyrus' men found the leaders drunken, and they killed King Belshazzar. It seems that after Daniel left, the king and his lords continued the party. Nobody sobered up after this very sobering situation. And if he fell into a drunken slumber, he never awoke. Then we see the dawn of the Silver Kingdom. Going back to the dream of Nebuchadnezzar and the great statue, there was the head of gold, but then the neck and the chest and the arms were of silver. And here is the beginning of this. And Darius the Median of the Medes took the kingdom, being Aramaic as he was son of, about or now 62 years old. 60 is 320s, 62 years old. The Medo-Persian Empire now takes over ruling the Jews. This is the fulfillment of the silver part of the statue of chapter 2. We're going to talk about Darius here in a moment. There is a man who is well-beloved in our Christian circles, John Whitcomb. He is known for his work, seminal work with Henry Morris on the Genesis flood. That was the thing that kind of brought him into notice. But he was and has been a Hebrew scholar for many, many years, and is now attending regularly Colonial Hills Baptist Church. So he's sort of our next-door neighbor now. But his work, his research, solved a long, long problem that Bible students had about this man, Darius. So we come now, we're still in Roman numeral 1, the times of the Gentiles, and we come to the final story in the historical section, Daniel in the lion's den. But we begin with the prominence of Daniel, and we are introduced now to Darius the ruler. So it pleased Darius. I stopped there because I wanted to talk about Darius. Unbelieving critics of the Bible long held that the references to Darius the Mede were an error, History, to the extent that it had been uncovered, has not named any ruler of the time as Darius. Let me just stop to say, think about this. To proclaim that the Bible is wrong because we haven't found anybody named Darius. Do you realize, you know, you have all these things buried in the earth that could explain a lot of stuff. You know, we've got people living over them. You don't say, excuse me, would you move your village while we unearth everything and look for clues? So only when they're building a new Walmart or something, they come in, they dig stuff up, they find stuff, they call in somebody, and there it is, something important. And then you give it to the scholars, and scholars read it and try to figure out what it was all about and all this kind of stuff. So archaeology is not an open book to mankind. Once in a great while, something of significance is found. Normally, it's garbage, you know, somebody left, buried, whatever. And sometimes there's a list in there that tells us something important. But to realize how little we have the ability to examine those ancient times, and then to say we know everything. So if the Bible says there was a guy named Darius, and we don't have any record of him, the Bible must be in error. That's a pretty arrogant concept. At any rate, this is what they said. Only a later Persian ruler was named Darius. It took the professor of ancient languages at Grace Theological Seminary up in Winona Lake, Indiana, to uncover the truth. In his book, Darius the Mede, John C. Whitcomb argues that the phrase in Daniel 9:1 was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans, quote, strongly suggests that he was not the absolute monarch of the Persian Empire, but was rather a subordinate. It had already mentioned Cyrus. However, he exercised vast administrative powers within the realm of the Chaldeans. The Chaldeans were that ethnic group right around the Persian Gulf. Chapter 6 of Daniel indicates that he, Darius, was a man with great administrative ability. Whitcomb explains that a great number of cuneiform tablets have been unearthed that name Gubaru as a powerful governor who Cyrus the Persian placed in charge of Babylonia after the collapse of Babylon in October 539 BC. It's called the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. When you think of it, it was primarily the Medes that began the kingdom. The Persians were kind of taken in alongside. The Persian rule and power grew until finally it was not Medo-Persian anymore. It was Persian Empire, and the Medians were subjected. So at the time of the collapse of Babylon, Cyrus the Persian was actually the one in charge, and Darius the Median of the Medes was under him. So that's the historical background of it. Whitcomb shows that Professor Oppenheim, who translated the Nabonidus Chronicle, mistakenly translated two different names as one. You have to pay close attention here. Ugbaru entered Babylon on the 16th day of Tishri, but died 3 weeks later on the 11th of Arashamnu. Gubaru, not Ugbaru, but Gubaru, was installed as governor of Babylon by Cyrus the Persian and ruled for many years. So one died, one was installed as the governor. The two cannot be the same man, though Professor Oppenheimer translated them both by the same name. So after much detailed and intense study, and by that I mean I don't want to tell you all that stuff, but I read it and it's kind of interesting to see how he worked through it. Whitcomb states this, "It is our conviction that Gubaru, the governor of Babylon and the region beyond the river, appears in the book of Daniel as Darius the Mede, the monarch who took charge of the Chaldean kingdom immediately following the death of Belshazzar, and who appointed satraps and presidents, including Daniel, to assist him in the governing of this extensive territory with its many peoples. Now, how could Gubaru and Darius be the same? Well, we do have a later name. It's quite possible that they had more than one name, that names were combined and so on. And often what's called a name is actually a title. So we don't know enough about it to understand exactly why. But this Gubaru is the man that we are calling Darius here. So, what about this Darius? Darius the organizer. We see the satraps. So Darius, it pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 princes, which should be over the whole kingdom. Now, let's suppose you are part of the government that was overthrown, now the capital city of Babylon, and the emperor puts you in charge as a king over a large area. Well, you know, you can't use internet, telephone, telegram. We have no instant communication. Communication is on horseback over many weeks and perhaps years of travel to get to the different areas. So what you have to do is to put people in charge locally. So what he did was to try to divide things up into 120 different districts and then put people that he could count on, people that would be loyal to him and to the kingdom in charge. The word princes is the word satraps in the original and means lower level governors in Persian authority. Some have argued that there were not 120 satrapies at the time, but that misses the point that Daniel was appointing 120 satraps, not creating new territories. So, or Darius, not Daniel. Darius was appointing, he was not making new territories, he was appointing princes over it. Then the presidents, and over these three presidents. So 120, that'd be about 40 under each president. The word president is to sit before, to preside is, side is to sit, and pre is before. So here's the guy who sits before the group. He's in charge. So over these three presidents, of whom Daniel was first. Now, last we saw Daniel, he was sort of in a retirement situation. He was not involved. Think about the situation. The whole kingdom changes. And the man searches out and finds Daniel. Here was a man, dare I say, a man of legend. Here was a man who, you know, prophesied. They came in and said, "Are you surprised?" "Well, no. Daniel told us that you were going." "What?" And so they find Daniel and so on. Here he is, an old man, but still really sharp. So Darius, being a good administrator, brings him in and puts him as first of the three presidents. And put him first, that the princes might give accounts unto them. The satrap is giving account to the presidents, and that the king should have no damage. You don't have people trying to usurp that authority on a local level. Since Darius was governing for Cyrus, he would have to give account at some time to protect himself, to be a good steward. He put watchdogs over the rulers. And then the viceroy, the vice king. This Daniel was preferred above the presidents and princes because an excellent spirit was in him. And the king thought to set him over the whole realm. Daniel was a worker. Daniel was able to handle these things. And so he thought, well, instead of just being first of the three presidents, I'll make a new office, my viceroy, and the three presidents will answer to him. So the king intended to create a new position. This would be viceroy, leader of all the presidents. It is interesting that the late Belshazzar had appointed Daniel as third ruler in the kingdom. Now that a new kingdom was in charge, Cyrus was the emperor, Darius was the governor, Daniel would be head of the presidents. He got his third position, and this time it actually meant something. But jealousy. So the plot against Daniel, we look at the failed plot, Daniel's faultlessness in business. Then the presidents and princes sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find none occasion nor fault, for as much as he was faithful, neither was there any error or fault found in him. And you can ask Dave Tunis that it's not always easy to present the account and it be faultless. On the deacon's meeting, every so often he says, oops, we'll have to change that, you know. By the way, always finding what was wrong and getting it corrected. But here's a fellow that checked and double-checked and whatever and had the time to do it. He didn't make any mistakes. And they were looking. They were looking. That's pretty good. This is a guy, you know, 81, 82 by now. Daniel, although in his 80s, being audited by men eager to find error, was found without error or fault in all his business dealings. So should we be as a testimony to God to others. I remember Cliff Howard telling me that he was a little hesitant to announce that he was a Christian where he was working long before he retired, because there was a man there who completely proclaimed that he was a Christian. He was perhaps the Christian at the job site. And he was a lazy, good-for-nothing guy, cheated on the break time, all this kind of stuff. Everybody said, okay, we see what a Christian is. And Cliff wanted to maybe show them that he was a Christian and not proclaim it. But we ought to be the faithful people, the ones who people admire, and then find out that we're Christians. Matthew 5:16, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works. But to what end? And glorify your Father which is in heaven. In 1 Peter 2:11-12, dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul, having your conversation, your manner of life, honest among the Gentiles, among the unsaved, that whereas they speak against you as evildoers, they may, by your good works, which they shall behold, glorify God in the day of visitation. The day of visitation is the day of judgment, when God visits them. And he says, but you had that example in front of you, didn't you? Yes, we did. So Daniel's faithfulness, his faultlessness in business, they had the first plot. Let's just find where he's mistaken, bring this up, play it up big. They couldn't find anything. And then Daniel's faithfulness in religion. Then said these men, we shall not find any occasion against this Daniel, except we find it against him concerning the law of his God. The plan that they invented shows that they expected Daniel to be absolutely unwavering in his devotion to Jehovah. That's amazing to me. They said, now, if we do something here that says you have to do something that would be against Jehovah, Daniel's not going to obey that. We know that. He's absolutely faithful to his God. The commentator Albert Barnes elaborates, the only question was how to construe his religious conduct in this respect as criminal. or how to make the king listen to any accusation against him on this account, for his religious views were well known when he was appointed to office. They can't say, hey, do you know that he worships? But everybody knew that. See? The worship of the God of Daniel was not prohibited by the laws of the realm, and it would not be easy to procure a law directly and avowedly prohibiting that. It is not probable that the king would have consented to pass such a law directly proposed, a law which would have been so likely to produce disturbance, and when no plausible ground could have been alleged for it. So there was another method, however, which suggested itself to these crafty counselors, which was, while they did not seem to aim absolutely and directly to have that worship prohibited, to approach the king with a proposal that would be flattering to his vanity, and that perhaps might be suggested as a test question showing the degree of esteem in which he was held in the empire and the willingness of his subjects to obey him. So pretty crafty people here and politically aware. So we see then the flattery plot, but we're out of time. So we'll get into the flattery plot. That's not the family plot. That's the flattery plot. Next time, chapter 6, verse 6.